Adult Choose. Recorded live.
Welcome and thank you for joining us. You're listening to the Beyond 50 radio program. I'm Daniel Davis. In 1967, which was just 3 years after I was born, one of the greatest rock pop albums of all time was created. The Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band would go on to be one of those icon albums that would actually set the tone and the standard of rock music and pop as we know it today. But even more important was what was happening in 1967 as the United States was engaged in the war in Vietnam. It was during 1967 that the Great March to Washington, in which hundreds of thousands of citizens of the United States would actually protest the war and hold our government under siege, simply stating, "You need to pull our boys out." That was their constitutional right to tell our government, which was by the people, for the people, and of the people, to say, "Stop what's happening in Vietnam." Unfortunately, we wouldn't pull out of Vietnam until close to 1975, which probably left a lot of us wondering for the next almost 10 years, where did our Constitution go? What kind of power does the Constitution actually give the people of the United States? Most importantly, how important is the Constitution today? Joining us here on the Beyond 50 radio program today is our guest, Mark Weber. He's going to be talking with us about the Constitution, what it means, and what power does it have left and its importance. And I'd like to welcome to the Beyond 50 radio program today our guest, Mr. Mark Weber. Mark, thank you for joining us here on the Beyond 50 radio program.
Thank you very much, Daniel, for having me on.
You bet. Now, let's talk about what the Constitution is. I know many of us know what it is, or we think we do, but interestingly enough, Mark, I've asked enough people, do you know what the Constitution is? Most of them can usually recite the First Amendment. But for the most part, I don't think they really know what it is.
Right, that's true. There's a lot of confusion. Probably in no country in the world is the Constitution looked upon in such a reverential way as it is here in the United States. But like many things that people admire and look at in this way, they know it more by its reputation than by what it actually says. There's just a couple of things I think that are really striking, and one is that those people who say they like the Constitution all tend to look at it in a way that is in keeping with their own particular view, and they won't agree with each other. Somebody will say, well, I like the Constitution because it guarantees freedom of speech, or I like the Constitution for this reason. But just like when people are talking about religion, they all put their own spin on it and don't really pay attention to what it actually has to say. To give just one example, the Constitution requires and spells out that war, if the United States goes to war, is to be declared by Congress. Well, the last time the United States Congress actually declared war on anyone was in 1941. And since then, the United States has gone to war many, many times, and you mentioned the Vietnam War, without a declaration of war. All of those conflicts are essentially unconstitutional. And in 1964, Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon was stuck his neck out in making the point that the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution authorizing massive U.S. military intervention in Vietnam was unconstitutional. And he was widely criticized at the time, but he was telling the truth. He was on solid ground with that. And the wars that the United States has fought in other countries since then, including in Iraq, were essentially not in keeping with violations of the U.S. Constitution. But those people, even many people who say, well, I support the Constitution, and that's very important, don't really care if it's violated when it comes to issues that they personally care about.
Now, in the Constitution, let's talk about what it is exactly, what it was meant for by the Founding Fathers, and whether or not, if they were to see it today, would say, well, I don't think this is really what we meant. Kind of give us an idea about that.
Right. I mean, one of the biggest contradictions is the fact that most people assume the Constitution is a blueprint for democracy. In fact, the Founding Fathers were very skeptical, very dubious about democracy, and the government that they set up through the Constitution prevented the people directly from having much of a say in much of anything. The original Constitution, first of all, it was written by a committee in secret. The public was not allowed to know until after the whole thing was over how the whole thing was being worked out. And, of course, it was a very small group of 55 men who worked out the Constitution without a great deal of input or without a mandate really from the population at large. But more than that, the system they set up required, for example, that the President of the United States was not to be elected by the people, certainly not directly. People were supposed to, or states, not the people directly, were to choose electors who then, not pledged to anybody in advance, would quietly contemplate and then choose a President of the United States. The people were not supposed to vote directly for the President. And under the original Constitution, the Senate of the United States was not to be voted for by the population. It was to be chosen by the state legislatures, and that didn't change until the early 19th century, into early 20th century. Moreover, voting was much more restricted than we're used to today. Voting was restricted to basically white, property-owning males. The majority of the population of the United States had no political power whatsoever. So the biggest contradiction is probably between the Constitution as the Founding Fathers envisioned it and the assumption that the Constitution is a vehicle for what we believe today, or what we accept today, as a democratic form of government.
Now, that's kind of fascinating. It almost seems like its own paradox.
It's a paradox. Yes, it's a paradox, but the Founding Fathers did not anticipate the way things would develop. The most obvious example of that is they didn't at all expect the rise of political parties. They expected and hoped and planned that the government of the United States would be run by men like themselves, who understood each other and who got along. One example of that, or one feature of that, is that in the Constitution, originally, the Electoral College was to vote for a president, and the person who came in the second, who got the second largest number of votes, was to be the vice president. In other words, it wasn't a conflict between two individuals with different points of view. The view was that the assumption was that people would get along so well that the person getting the most votes would be president, and then the person he would work with, the vice president, would be the person getting the second number of votes. There's no provision in the original Constitution for political parties as they emerged. And the first president of the United States, George Washington, was basically chosen without any regard to political party, or, as the Founding Fathers used to say, factions. And they were very, very worried about this whole spirit of what they called factions or partisanship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that went out the window very early. My point is that the Founding Fathers didn't really anticipate or expect how quickly issues of rivalry and competition and contention would arise in the American public as quickly and as forcefully as it did.
You know, it's really interesting to look at this 2010 after Obama's been elected, and you've seen the mudslinging just blatant. I think a lot of people, regardless of what side of the fence you were on, were to a point that we were just getting tired of the nonsense. You know, here this is we the people, but it's, well, we on this side, not you on the other side, and how we became a country that is so divided against itself when we're supposed to be working together.
Right, that's true. There's, I think, all across the country, a really wide sense that the government just isn't responsive. And here in California, that's really become quite a big thing. People are just they feel helpless. They feel
mm-hmm.
that whoever they vote for, Republican or Democrat, that the people in power, and again, people aren't so, they disagree among themselves. We disagree about who that is. They're just going to do what they want anyway. And the Constitution in all of this has basically become sort of irrelevant. A good example was when the economic crisis began during the final months of the Bush administration. The Treasury Secretary and the head of the Federal Reserve and President Bush insisted that the Congress immediately authorize astonishing that the Congress, and at first there was a lot of opposition or resistance to this, but the president went on, and we were told, unless this is passed immediately, the whole country's falling apart. And right. The Congress did pass it. Well, the astonishing thing is, the Treasury Secretary then, a few months later, said he was going to spend the money differently than he had originally pledged. Now, my point is that the Congress, in effect, turned over to the federal government an enormous part of its own authority. In effect, it said, we're not even going to debate how this million or that billion is going to be spent. We're just going to authorize it, and you just decide how it's all going to be spent. That's pretty amazing and very, very different than what the Founding Fathers ever really imagined. But the federal government has expanded far, far beyond what the original Founding Fathers ever imagined. So that the federal government is involved in all sorts of programs and policies far beyond what the Founding Fathers and early Americans could ever possibly have imagined. And whether people are conservative or liberal, this is generally accepted by the American people. Very few conservatives, for example, would think that the federal government shouldn't be running the national park system. Most people are happy we have national parks, but there's no provision in the Constitution for that. There's no provision at all. In fact, it's unconstitutional for the United States to have this very extensive Social Security system. But almost every American now thinks that takes that for granted. But the original Constitution and Article 10 of the amendments specifically say that any powers or authority not specifically delegated to the federal government are not to be carried out by the federal government, but are supposed to be reserved for the states and the people. Well, we've gone way, way beyond that. And even those people who say they uphold the Constitution, I think, are not really very serious or consistent when they say that.
You know, Mark, you bring up some really fascinating things for us to explore here, especially what I would call a government flip-flop. Again, it doesn't really matter who's in office.
Right.
I'm going to cite a couple of examples. One of the, to me, as I discovered what the truth was of what I would consider the most gross acts of our government was the day that down in Texas, in Waco, Texas, that they stormed in and those people had died in Waco, Texas, practicing their own religion. And when you really follow through the story, you realize here was a, if you want to go ahead and call them a cult, that's fine, but they had existed for more than 60 years peaceably. Somehow along the way, somebody decided, I believe it was Janet Reno, says, well, I've got this new security squad that I want to try out, and for whatever reason decided to go and do what they did, and it turned into a real mess. Even though the people on the compound had defended themselves and killed three of the agents, and it was proved by the Supreme Court of the United States and Congress that they were acquitted because of self-defense, they continued to go in and do what they were doing anyway. So here you have our First Amendment, the right to religious practice and religious freedom, but yet somehow they came up with something of the idea of the welfare of the United States to be able to go in there and say, well, I think these guys are a problem. We're going to end this. So now when you talk about the states and how the states should have the power, it sounds like, to deal with a situation like this, the federal government just kind of stormed in and did whatever they wanted to do. But now you take a look at this immigration situation that's happening in Arizona, and it's like our government saying, well, that's up to Arizona to deal with. Mm-hmm. You know, it just kind of flip-flops. It's like whatever they decide. Then you mentioned California. I watched an interesting documentary about the marijuana laws here in the state of California had passed and said it's okay for you to legally dispense this, realizing, hey, this is a cash cow for the government. But yet then you have federal agents coming in and raiding these places and shutting them down. And it's like, okay, so which way are you going to go here?
Right. That's always been an ambiguity between the authority of the federal government and the state government. One odd thing is that many people who say, the states' rights are very important, nonetheless don't like it if states do things and make policies that go against them. For example, you'll have all sorts of states' rights people say, well, that's a very important principle, we should uphold that. But if a state says, well, we're going to legalize gay marriage, they say, no, you can't do that. So very often people pick and choose what principles they want to uphold depending on whether it's in accord with their own feelings or agenda and not really the basic principle involved. They're not willing to uphold a principle when it goes against their own wishes and their own desires.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were talking earlier about Social Security programs, Medicaid, Medicare, the Interstate Highway Program. Geez, the infrastructure, you can kind of really go down the highway on that one and get upset about what's going on there. And you talked about the National Park System, you know, aids to education, food stamp programs, and the like. But there seems to be a question of whether or not legally these are considered constitutional programs. Could you elaborate on that for us?
Well, there's a clause of the Constitution that stipulates and says that the Congress is empowered to pass laws for the general welfare.
Mm-hmm.
This general welfare clause has now been interpreted by people who run the government and by the courts to basically justify just about anything. Almost anything can be justified on the basis that it serves the, quote, general welfare.
Right.
And on that basis, then, the government is involved in all sorts of things that the early Americans thought were something that the federal government should stay out of. Education, for example. For most of American history, education was purely either a private or a local or perhaps a state matter. There were state universities and so forth. But the federal government had no role, virtually no role at all in education until the middle of the 20th century. Now it's very, very deeply involved in education policies across the country. That's really pretty clearly unconstitutional. The proof
mm-hmm.
of that is the fact that for most of American history, the federal government was not involved at all in that. But again, people, if it's expeditious, if they think this is what we want, they don't really care about the principle. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but the point is the Constitution is it's what people make of it. And the best example of that is when we look around the world and look at constitutions. For example, Mexico and Haiti have constitutions that are very similar to the U.S. Constitution. But nobody thinks that the societies of those two countries are all that similar to the United States. A constitution and the form of constitutional government is not the same as the form of society. A constitution doesn't make a society prosperous or free from corruption or crime-free or crime-ridden. A constitution is just a legal vehicle. On the other hand, Britain has never even had a written constitution. But its society is remarkably stable over time because people accept and understand and embrace these cultural and political traditions, and they don't have to spell it all out. And other countries, which might have a written constitution, they can be very chaotic and disordered, even though they have a constitution in place that supposedly guarantees rights and maps out a very stable society on paper.
Now, it was in 1791, as I understand, that the Bill of Rights were approved, and this was 10 amendments to the Constitution. Why was this enacted?
People were very skeptical that the Constitution, you know, the U.S. Constitution, by the way, that we have now is actually the second Constitution of the United States.
With all the amendments, I could see why.
Well, no. The first Constitution was the Articles of Confederation,
mm-hmm.
which provided for a very loose union of more or less sovereign states. When the Constitution that we have now was worked out, it was worked out in secret, and many people were very fearful and dubious about it because it didn't have. They were fearful that it would take too many freedoms and powers, and so the people who pushed for the approval of the new Constitution that we have agreed that to help offset these fears, that they would enact the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. But as I said, they've been ignored. Article 10 of the Constitution, of the Bill of Rights, says specifically that powers not delegated to the federal government are reserved to the states and to the people. This was a way to hem in and restrict the power of the federal government. But that's basically been just ignored. In 1941, the Supreme Court declared Article 10 of the Constitution a truism. In other words, it's nice there, but it's really irrelevant. And most Americans don't really care as long as the policies carried out are ones that they approve of. But the first 10 amendments there were introduced and adopted to try to reassure people that the federal government was not going to overstep its bounds.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's even interesting today, because of the Obama administration running on, you know, health care reform, is one of the big things that I've heard a lot of rumbling about is that making it mandatory for every single American to cover some sort of health care coverage. Now, I remember the frustration that I felt back in the 1980s when the state of Oregon had actually passed, which to me was a good thing to pass, but it also has its downside, and that is requiring every driver to have automobile insurance, at least minimum liability. But the problem with something like that in requiring something is that when you have privatization, for instance, of an insurance industry, is who's to stop them from deciding how much that coverage is going to cost? And I think that partially is one of the concerns I would think the American people would have is, for instance, you know, there's that nasty rising health care cost, but telling us that we have to have it when many Americans are having a hard time just keeping food on the table and rent paid.
Right. Well, there has quite a few people have raised this matter as a constitutional issue and say that it's unconstitutional for the government to require citizens to purchase something from a private company. I mean, imagine if the federal government said, we require that you purchase so much a year in clothing, for example. Well,
mm-hmm.
They'd say that's ridiculous. But the key point here is they're requiring people to get something from a private company, to buy something from a corporation, that is, in this case, healthcare. Now, the comparison with automobile insurance is a little different because it's tied up with owning and operating a car. And courts have held, I think justifiably, that if you have a car, then you incur a certain obligation to the society and the community when you drive a car on public roads, because you're not just driving the car on your private ground, you're driving it on roads that
right.
are owned by the community. So it's not quite the same as health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
The requirement that people buy health insurance is one that it involves a government telling you've got to buy something from a private vendor, an insurance company, and that's very dubious constitutionally. You know, I mean, more in foreign affairs, it's just amazing. Even more than that, the original cabinet of the United States had a so-called War Department to deal with military affairs and a Navy Department, but we now have expanded the military so immensely, we have a so-called Department of Defense, but it doesn't operate primarily for defense, and that's why after 9/11 we set up a whole new branch called the Department of Homeland Security to do what the founding fathers intended the War Department to handle.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, in a sense, two military branches, the Department of Homeland Security that's supposedly set up to defend America, and the Department of Defense, which I think more accurately could be called the Department of Imperial Outreach or something like that, because it has troops all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
But this is, again, far, far, far beyond what the founding fathers, and I think even most Americans, ever really envisioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're certainly becoming more and more aware and awake to that particular fact, but you get to a point now, especially after 9/11, when the Patriot Act was, you know, implemented, you think, okay, do we even really have a constitution anymore? Or do we just kind of lay down? Or, you know, what is it that we can do to mainly gain that footing back?
Right, yeah. I think history shows, and when we look around the world and even in our own history, a constitution is not much of a restriction on those people who really have power. The Constitution in America, I think, has become essentially a legal vehicle by those who do have power to do more or less what they want to do anyway. Mm-hmm. There are very few restrictions from any constitutional point of view on what those people in power and who want a law passed or want policies implemented from doing that. That's just the reality. What's really decisive is not the Constitution, either in America or other countries. What's decisive is who has power and who wields it. Mm-hmm. And again, the examples of that, if we look overseas, are pretty obvious. Britain doesn't have a constitution at all, but there are restrictions on the government by custom and by a mutual agreement. Canada didn't have a constitution until the 1980s. Now, there are restrictions on the Soviet Union had a constitution that in many ways seemed like a great document, but of course it was a legal vehicle used by under the Soviet system by the Communist Party to basically do whatever it wanted. And that's unfortunately the reality. You know, the First Amendment, the Constitution, for example, guarantees freedom of speech. But we have all sorts of restrictions on freedom of speech that we more or less accept. One of them, for example, it's illegal to put on television or a newspaper advertising for cigarettes. Now, there's maybe a good argument for saying that's for doing that. I mean, you could say, well, I understand why that should be done. But the point is, it's a restriction on freedom of speech that is certainly one that the founding fathers never would have understood or accepted.
I kind of wonder how their attitude would have been toward Larry Flint.
Well, one of the amazing things is that when the founding fathers and the American people enacted the First Amendment guaranteeing freedom of speech, they never imagined that it would be interpreted the way it is now to justify, for example, mockery or belittling of religion.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that was just way beyond the pale. They never imagined that it would be used to defend pornography, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It was beyond what they had in mind, and what they wanted was a guarantee that different political views, different views about history and current affairs would be guaranteed and supported. Remember, at the time the Constitution was passed, in many states of the original 13 states, there were established religions, established churches in about half the states of the United States at that time. And people were required on the state level to divert some of their tax money had to go to support a church. They never imagined that the First Amendment would be construed and interpreted the way it has been.
Now, I think one of the most phenomenal things that I believe really churns a lot of people's blood is the fact that when you talk about taxes, that was our whole reason from getting away from England. We
right.
just got sick and tired of having our toil and our work just merely taken away from all of our, you know, labor, and then here you're left with the minimum, you know, while everybody else sits high and pretty.
Right.
And in fact, as I understand this, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it was just before, during the World War II effort, they enacted what was called a voluntary tax. In other words, you're welcome to pay taxes to fund the war effort, buy war bonds, and, you know, patriotically speaking, citizens of the United States were saying, yeah, we'll do this. But then it became a law. Now you can go to jail if you decide just not to pay taxes.
No, well, it's slightly mixing things. It was during World War II as a so-called temporary measure
mm-hmm.
that taxes were taken out of your pay ahead of time. The original Constitution prohibited an income tax at all. And it wasn't until an amendment to the Constitution was finally approved in 1913, I think, that made it legal to have a federal income tax. But up until World War II, it was paid at the end of the year. During the World War II, the government instituted, supposedly again, as a temporary expedient measure, withholding of part of your taxes from your paycheck, and then, but that so-called temporary measure has now become very, very permanent, of course, as everybody well knows.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's another interesting example, the 2000 election. George W. Bush, according to many, had basically stolen the election in Florida. Yet there was a process that was supposed to be followed through, and I don't know if it's a constitutional one, but please elaborate on this. What happened there that if, in fact, you know, Al Gore actually won, what went wrong there?
Well, there's two issues here.
Okay.
First of all, there's no question. Whatever your point of view about the election of 2000, that that Al Gore actually got more votes than George W. Bush. The question was whether the electoral votes in Florida really went to George Bush or Al Gore. But regardless of your point of view about that, Al Gore actually got more votes because we have a very peculiar electoral system whereby smaller states have much more representation than larger states. That's because the number of electoral votes of each state is determined by the number of senators and representatives in Congress. So that means that smaller states are guaranteed at least three electoral votes, even if their population is very small, like Wyoming or Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And so the result can be, if the votes are distributed in a certain way, one candidate can get more votes and still lose in the Electoral College. And that's happened a number of times in American history.
Mm-hmm.
The election of 2000 is not the only example of that. And it's a little strange for me and amusing that America is constantly pointing fingers at other countries saying, you don't do things in the right way, you don't do it in a real democratic way, when our constitutional system, our system of government, makes it possible for the loser in an election to actually become the president.
You know, it's interesting you point out other countries around the world, because I think that's a lot of the hotbed issue in Latin America, is that here people in Latin America are, as I understand, following democracy and electing leaders that are really clearly trying to represent them and their own personal interest in their countries, especially
right.
when it comes to natural resources. But yet somehow there's always a weird little coup, or, you know, maybe it's a Soviet satellite communist outpost, and we find a reason to go in there and overthrow these leaders that are actually truly democratically elected by the people. It's quite
right.
amazing.
Yes, that's right. And that's a real contradiction between our proclaimed ideas and what we've done. Well,
up here we steal them, down there you vote them in, but we take them out.
There's been some very remarkable examples of that. One was Arbenz in Guatemala.
Right.
Overthrew his government.
Torrijos was another one.
Well, and in Iran in 1953, the United States organized the overthrow of the Mossadegh government because the United States was fearful that he would, and as Iran did eventually, nationalize the oil industry of that country.
Mm-hmm.
But Mossadegh and his policies were, of course, immensely popular. And now, in the Middle East, the United States supports regimes, notably in Egypt or Jordan, which are not at all democratic, because the U.S. is fearful that a really democratic government will be more hostile to the United States than the ones that are in place right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mark, because you're very astute about the Constitution, what it is, okay, is it still important, and is there anything in the Constitution that has teeth for the citizens of the United States that they would just become more versed in it?
I think the most important feature of the Constitution that's still a good one and still valid is basically, even though it's violated in some ways, is the First Amendment, the guarantee of freedom of speech. The First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law restricting freedom of speech. That's pretty blanket. That's pretty categorical.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the U.S. government has almost, with very few exceptions, been able to really severely restrict freedom of speech. That's probably the most, I think, valuable feature of the U.S. Constitution that's in place that the American people that's good. That's a really good one.
Mm-hmm.
But the other features, they seem to be violated depending all the time, depending on whatever people in power want. And I've given the examples of wars that we go to and we've been involved in. But there's many others as well. But we've gotten into a situation, I think, where the Constitution, because of the elastic nature of the general welfare clause and other things, is now just basically a legal vehicle used by those in power to do whatever they want. And there's many, many examples of that. And we've seen the whole business with immigration and so forth. I think one of the most disturbing aspects is the American people don't hold their leaders really to account. If the American leaders, political leaders, carry out policies that are unconstitutional or even illegal or deceitful, we don't really punish them. We don't really hold them to account.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want to get too partisan here, but it's unquestionable, I think, that the invasion of Iraq was carried out on the basis of at least deceit or misleading information. But George Bush is retired. He's no longer president. But the mood in the country and the mood of most people is just, well, let bygones be bygones. In other words, he's not held to account for his actions. And that's, to me, pretty astonishing, because hardly anything is more disruptive and harmful to a society than going to war.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's acknowledged now across the board that the reasons given for going to war in Iraq turned out to be untrue, and that the war was, I think, pretty clearly a violation of our Constitution, going to war without a real declaration of war,
mm-hmm.
Nobody's holding those people who supported the war, most notably former President Bush, to account for having done that.
It's really fascinating, because it was about a year ago that we had Vincent Bugliosi on the program, and he was promoting a book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush,
right,
for Murder, you know. And
yeah.
So he says he's actively out there doing this. But here's what was funny. I was actually at a restaurant one time, not too long after that, and I was talking with a couple, and it was interesting. You know, it was just kind of one of them passing conversations while you're waiting for a table. And I brought that up, and the guy says, fat chance, that's never going to happen.
Yeah.
And what does he do? He flashes a Secret Service badge of the Bush administration.
Wow.
I went, wow. He says, wow, there ain't no way that's going to happen.
Right.
And I thought to myself, well, if he can't, along with Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld, which I feel were really strong culprits about some of Bush's decisions, you know, if that can't happen, then, you know, you can almost look at the citizens of the United States and go, what does it then matter? What can we do?
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, our institute has sold Bugliosi's book, and I've read it very, very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
He may overstate the case somewhat, but the basic point he makes is a very, very valid and, I think, irrefutable one.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the Bush administration did things that are just really illegal. And I guess the proof of that is that we hold and have held leaders in other countries accountable, even at the cost of their lives, for doing actions that we have permitted by our own government. I mean, most notably, after World War II, we put German leaders on trial and executed a number of them for, as we said, waging aggressive war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, regardless of what you know, how bad the German leaders were or whatever, we do not hold our own leaders to the same standard.
Mm-hmm.
And when a country does that, when it has a double standard like that, then it means that executing the leaders of another country for policies that we allow ourselves to do means that what we were doing is not really justice, but a kind of judicial killing, a kind of judicial murder.
Here's what I also find fascinating, too, when you take a look at the back-to-back comparisons of, you know, what the right thing to do is versus, well, why did we decide this was the right thing? And that is, you put the Bill Clinton administration next to the George W. Bush administration. Now, here was a guy that had impeachment proceedings going on because of a sexual activity that he lied about. Okay. But here's Bush, according to what everybody's been able to find out, who just misled us into a war. I don't know which one of those two really affect the citizens of the United States the most.
Right, yeah. Well, That's a real problem. And that's why it is important to be to uphold principle. And if people take an oath to uphold the laws and the Constitution, they should be held accountable when they don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, and I think this is a trend that's been going on for quite a few years, the American public has become so increasingly disillusioned, a feeling of just kind of helplessness has really spread across the country, that people in power just sort of do whatever they want, regardless of what the American people think. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I'll give one example. Some years ago, the people of California passed a referendum, approved a law forbidding state money going to illegal immigrants. Now, whether you think that's a good or bad thing, that was something that the people of California voted for.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened after that is that the leaders of both major parties and the courts basically threw that out, saying, no, we're not going to enforce that. We're not going to do that. Now, that was just one example after that, that one case that led a lot of people in California to think, well, what's the use? What's the point?
Right.
If we make clear as well as we possibly can, this is what we want, and the courts just say, in effect, screw you, well, people just think, well, what's the good? Now, another example, again, here in California, 8 years ago, people were so furious at the administration of Governor Gray Davis because he wanted to increase the automobile registration tax or automobile registration fees and other taxes, that Gray Davis was removed in a referendum, and Arnold Schwarzenegger became governor, promising very loudly that he was never going to increase taxes and he was going to fight the so-called special interests. Well,
mm-hmm.
here it is 8 years later, and he has approved all sorts of increases in taxes, and the situation economically or in the budget here in California is far worse than it was when Gray Davis was thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
And Arnold Schwarzenegger came in this huge popular feeling of revolt, as it were, against the Gray Davis administration, and the situation is now worse.
Mm-hmm.
Another example, nationally, is that Barack Obama was elected on the promise of change in large measure, not completely, but in large measure, because people were very, very unhappy with the Iraq War, and they wanted a reduction of America's imperial or military role around the world. But in fact, under Barack Obama, the military budget has gotten larger. Barack Obama has approved increases in military spending and has increased the U.S. military presence and the spying and so forth, or targeted assassinations around the world. And so the feeling from the American people as a result of all this is, well, what's the use? What's
mm-hmm.
the good?
Mm-hmm.
We vote for people on the basis of pledges and promises they make, and then they do something else. So that the American public just increasingly feels impotent, frustrated, and irrelevant to the
mm-hmm.
whole process.
You know, you bring up a very interesting point in the state of California when Gray Davis was, what's the word they use for that when you vote somebody in, but then you just decide, well, we're going to take them out?
Well, he's recalled.
Recalled, that's what it is, okay. Now, that's an interesting law in and of itself because of the reason it was originally implemented was during the time that, you know, the railroads were going up and they wanted to be sure that if an elected official was put into office and was deemed highly corrupted or corruptible, that was a way you could have them removed just for that reason.
Right.
But that wasn't what was really, well, seemingly going on during the Gray Davis administration. It was just a guy saying, I think we had to, you know, increase taxes for whatever motivations you have. But I wouldn't see that as a reason of corruption.
No. Well, you're right, yes. I mean, it wasn't.
Why don't we just recall him?
Well, right. The original referendum and recall initiatives that were introduced in the United in states around the country, was largely motivated to get rid of people because they had broken the laws, they were corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't even from the very beginning. It was also a political thing. If somebody were, if a governor or somebody or representative was carrying out policies very contrary to what people, very early on, people were doing it even for political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you mentioned the Bill Clinton administration and how what a political animal zoo that became eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he did lie about his sexual escapades, but as you point out, that's nothing compared to the lies and deceit and the consequences of those of lies that other presidents have carried out. But obviously, what was the determining factor was that people wanted to get Bill Clinton, and they didn't really care about the specific issue upon that
mm-hmm.
he seized upon to do that.
Mm-hmm. Which is even more interesting because here he's a political, or he's a public servant. Now, isn't there a constitutional law or amendment that states that you, if you, let's say, you have a lawsuit against someone who's holding a public position, that that's not allowed to happen until after they are out of office and finished with their duties as a public servant?
Well, I think I'm not very clear about this. There is a law like that.
It was in the 1940s, I believe, that it was enacted. But anyway,
right.
Go ahead.
Right, but certainly impeachment is something that can be done and should, I mean, according to the Constitution, should be done when somebody is actually in office. The process of impeachment is actually written into the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
An impeachment, according to the Constitution, is only to be carried out for high crimes and misdemeanors.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if lying about a sexual escapade is a high crime and misdemeanor, that's, you know, very dubious. But the only other time in America in which there was a serious effort to impeach the president was President Johnson in the aftermath of the Civil War, and that was similarly very politically motivated.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't really based on principle. It was based on pretty narrow political reasons, I think.
So, Mark, what can we do as citizens of the United States to feel like in ways we're taking our rights as citizens back through the Constitution? Is that even possible?
Well, certainly people should, in spite of the discouraging situation we're in, and I'm afraid it's going to continue like this for a while,
mm-hmm.
People should be as informed and as involved as they possibly can. But if I could just make one basic point, it's to try to elect and support political figures who are principled, who have a track record of going against powerful interests and who uphold their principles, even if you don't sometimes agree with them completely. I don't want to name names,
mm-hmm.
but at least individuals like that have principles and they'll stick by them, because it doesn't do anybody any good to elect somebody on the basis of claims they make, and they do something very different when they're actually elected, and that's increasingly the situation that we're seeing in our country.
You know, and I also think too, in the years that we've been doing our show, and when we have political talks such as the one that we're having today about, you know, what our government is and the Constitution, what our rights are, and what we can do is that, you know, geez, now I kind of lost my train of thought just as you were saying what you were saying there about taking action. Oh, what I was going to say is what's really become fascinating about America, especially its politics and elections, is it doesn't really seem to matter to us anymore who the right person is for the job in as much as that we vote for the person who wins. And I remember watching a small documentary. It was about a guy that was running against another person for, I think it was governor of a particular state, and the fact that the opponent actually had family, that he had a history of politics in his family, was riding on that coattail. And here this guy actually was refreshing, great ideas, enthusiasm, energy, you know, things that he was willing to do. But people were saying, you know, this sounds great and I want to vote for you, but I want my vote to at least be in the winning column, so I'm going to go this direction instead.
Right. That's true. Yeah, people are afraid of voting for someone who they think is trustworthy if that person seems like he or she won't win. They
mm-hmm.
want to go with a winner.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if there's any one point that might be made, it's the amazing contrast between the original Constitution, the way the country was set up originally, in which it was actually very distrustful of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
maybe a part of the problem is we have an electorate that is just basically very ill-informed and is easily persuaded by slogans.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here in California, so I'm going to refer to it. We're having an election coming up for governor. The Republican nominee, Meg Whitman, was unknown until a year ago, earlier this year, when she spent part of her enormous fortune to campaign for governor. But her ads on radio and television were just very simplistic. They were very superficial. They just said, we have to concentrate on increasing jobs, making education better, and lowering taxes. Well, everybody in theory thinks those are great things. But she was able, because she's a former president of eBay and has an enormous amount of money, was able to basically buy the Republican nomination for governor of California. Mm-hmm. Now, this is disturbing because she wouldn't have gotten that position except that slogans and slick ads paid for with money are able to persuade lots of people. And the form of government that we had originally was not like that because the leadership of the country didn't appeal and was not able to appeal to the mass of people. To put it another way, men like George Washington, James Madison, people like Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, they never not only would be elected today, they wouldn't even begin to even run for president because they wouldn't put up with the circus that electioneering has become in our country.
Mm-hmm.
I think another problem is that political elections now, or election campaigning, appeals to people who psychologically want or desire affirmation by crowds, by large numbers of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that the people who are most likely to run for office, in one sense, are the least qualified psychologically. Because what we want are leaders who are not impressed by or crave that kind of affirmation. But it's a sorry situation that the leaders of our of the past, who we look upon with some admiration, they just wouldn't get elected. They wouldn't get out of the starting gate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you read and study the Lincoln-Douglas debates in Illinois when Lincoln and Douglas were running for Senate, it's remarkable how cogent, how intelligent, how involved and complex the speeches and arguments were of those two candidates. Their arguments and presentations that today people wouldn't pay attention. They'd tune out after the first 2 minutes. Even the most so-called smart and cogent and capable, eloquent political leaders still speak in very short sound bites because the attention span of the American people has become very, very short, very, very quick.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is that making arguments and points that require thought and reflection and following a series of points to a logical conclusion is just not possible now by political candidates.
It's funny you bring up debates, and it seems to our listening audience maybe we're getting a little bit off track about what really we're talking about, which is the Constitution, but in many ways this is a morphism of a result of how the Constitution has evolved in ways that I'm sure our founding fathers would go, are these people out of their minds? Where do they even come up with this? But an example of what you were just talking about on the debates was the 2009 election debates, Barack Obama, Senator John McCain, and then you had Sarah Palin and Joe Biden. Now, what was funny was, the debates themselves, just as you said, it did sound like a lot of sound bites when, you know, you've got 2 minutes to say what you got to say, and now you got 2 minutes. But what was funny wasn't so much that in and of itself, to me, I found a little hysterical, but it was Stephanopoulos and the panel as though they were reviewing a diving match. I give her an 8.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, are you out of your mind?
Yeah. Quite right, yeah. And increasingly, our commentators on television put all these in terms of a kind of competitive entertainment, a kind of a
exactly
a game, and this involves our future. This involves the future of our children, our children's children. It involves these are very serious matters. They have enormous consequences, and this isn't a game. It's not. This isn't American Idol. And at the end, we just say, well, you're good.
They might as well have had Sharon Osbourne and Pierce there doing the debate.
Yeah. No, and look, I don't want to, again, be very partisan.
No, and we're not trying to be at all, believe me. We're using the common sense that seems to have been lost.
But I am struck that many people who support Sarah Palin support her in large part because they like the fact that she's so simple. They think that because she isn't very knowledgeable or educated or sophisticated, that she's going to be more understanding of their own needs and wants than somebody who's well-educated or sophisticated or whatever. But that's a very sorry situation. What we want leaders not only in political life, but if it's the pilot of your airplane or your dentist or the coach of your sports team, you want people as capable, as knowledgeable, as seasoned and as experienced as possible. And hopefully they represent the long-term interests of our country and our people as well. But to support somebody in at least in part because they're uneducated and unsophisticated is a very, very sorry situation, especially when it's contrasted with the learning and the thoughtfulness of men like, again, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, James Madison, or even Abraham Lincoln. These people were very astute and intelligent thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
And the contrast with the level of discourse now in our political life is just a very, very sorry one.
You know, and you take a look, as we're closing here, at the situation now with the Obama administration and all the news time being spent about racial slurs and racism.
Yep.
And it's like, I thought we were moving away from that even after voting a black president in, but it seems now they've got a whole new tornado they're trying to lasso. Could you tell us a little bit about that,
yeah,
if you wouldn't mind?
Well, that's true. And again, this is part of the spectacle that American public life and political life has come down to,
mm-hmm,
is who's offended? Oh, somebody's offended. Well, golly, for heaven's sake. I mean, this is almost childish, really.
Mm-hmm.
But the media likes a story with conflict. And so our media, our news coverage focuses on who's offended, who's outraged, what conflict there is. Well, this is really more in the realm of entertainment than anything that's really constructive. And that's just a very, very sorry situation. I mean, across the board, that's just a feature of American life that's very, very disturbing. The lower level of political and social discussion in America, and again, to go back to Vincent Bugliosi, his book is well worth reading, even apart from what he says about George Bush. He writes with great feeling about how the country has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Something is very, very different in America than the country that he grew up with as a boy and a young man. Something is missing. Something's gone. And to just maybe sum up, that has very little to do with the Constitution. It has to do with the nature of our people and our society.
As they would say, welcome to Hollywood, and Jack Nicholson would say, this is as good as it gets. Well, let's hope not. Let's hope it gets better.
Right.
Mark Weber, thank you for joining us on the program. If you could please go ahead and give out a website where people can find out more about your work for our listeners.
Yes, our website is ihr.org. It's very easy to get to. The site has a tremendous amount of information covering a lot of issues, and I think that many of your listeners will benefit from it.
Well, like I said, our aim on the program is just to present good information for people to make good decisions on their own without swaying them either way, and I hope that we've been able to achieve that here today.
Thank you very much for having me on, Dan.
Mark Weber, thank you for being on the program. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We also want to thank you, the listeners out there, for tuning in. Be sure to visit us at our website at beyond50radio.com. That's the number 50, and sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter. Be sure also to visit us on our blog where we archive our shows, have great multimedia information, YouTube videos, and hot links for you to be able to explore the many things that we like to present for you here today. We thank you again for tuning in. This is the Beyond 50 Radio Program. I'm Daniel Davis, and remember, live your day past halfway.